It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And we are joined this morning once again by none other than Jov Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, amongst other things. How are you both this morning?
We're
great.
You were doing sign language there for a minute.
Yeah. No, last week I was pretty indisposed, but this week I'm doing much, much better.
All right. That's good to hear, and of course, good not to see. So we've got a lot to cover this week, so let's just dive right into that, shall we? You couldn't help but miss it in the media this week. WorldCom, Xerox, ditto for the rest of corporate America, seems to all be falling apart.
Yeah, Ralph just was talking about that too. But there's an awful lot he didn't get to, starting with the fact that that was taped, of course, before the Xerox headline started.
Yes, that's right. Do you want to
go for it?
Okay, I'll go for it. Ralph made a good point. He talked about how it's a structural problem and not specific to any one company. It's interesting because when Enron broke, people were saying, "Oh, it's only Enron." And then when other companies started to go down, they were saying, "Well, it's only just the recession. It's post September 11th." And now that WorldCom has hit, they're saying, "Well, it's not just Enron. It's also maybe the telecommunications industry." So,
or Arthur Andersen's clients.
Yeah, or it's just the clients of Arthur Andersen. But in this case, we have Xerox. And now Xerox is neither a telecommunications company, nor is it an energy trading company. It's a company that's been around for a long, long time, and a company you would expect to be in fairly good shape. And it has infrastructure, has assets, et cetera. But it also has a little cash flow problem, and it also has to make probably one of the biggest adjustments in recent history to its books, a $6 billion change in its revenue.
Yeah, which was triggered by the fact that it had already been caught for previous malfeasance, and so they were going through and auditing more carefully to report to the SEC. So
that's right.
This is a crime on top of a crime.
So yeah, they've turned up 2 to 3 times more revenue that was booked incorrectly than they did the first time. So, and the interesting thing about Xerox, the most interesting thing I think, is that it's not an Arthur Andersen client. It's a client of another accounting firm, KPMG, another one of the big accounting firms, and that's going to cause major panic, I think.
Yeah, one of the things that has permeated the coverage of all these various cases of corporate malfeasance as well, it was the high-flying 90s. And, it was because of the boom times and all that. And that's very true. And the deregulation and the lack of enforcement of what few laws did remain are also very true. But it's systemic, not just in terms of how corporate America behaved, but how corporate America has bought off our political system. So you have the spectacle this week of George Bush getting up at the podium and saying this corporate behavior is unacceptable. Corporations have a responsibility to be good public citizens, yada, 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 yada. Here's a man number one who, well, he wasn't elected, but he came close enough that he could conceivably be, you know, rationalized as having been elected by much of the money that was made off of this boom. A man who shattered and at least doubled all of the previously outrageous records for campaign spending, much of it from many of the companies who engaged in this type of accounting practices. And then beyond that, George Bush is spending a little bit of time in front of the cameras doing his daily press routine thing and talking about this. And then he shuttles off and spends most of the better part of the rest of his days all summer long cramming in as much fundraising as possible for soft money contributions before those contributions become illegal this fall. And who is he going to for those contributions? Many of these same types of companies. So it's,
he's actually trying to get those companies to contribute before they go under.
Yeah, it's very true. So it's very two-faced. And it's not that George Bush is the only guy doing this. He just happens to be the most effective and the most prominent. But it permeates both the Democratic and the Republican parties. This is how business is done. This is how politics is done. And one of the reasons why Congress isn't hearing that much from the American public, Ralph Nader was just talking about the public being apathetic. It's not necessarily that the public is apathetic. The public doesn't believe that people who are bought and paid for by criminals are going to respond to calls to crack down on the criminals.
And in addition, the public doesn't really understand. There isn't a lot of information out there provided for people to really understand how these deals were made in the first place. I mean, people come up to me all the time and they say, "Maria, can you explain this to me?" And really, I can give them all the details they want, but what they really need to know, all they really need to know, is that there was no oversight. I mean, you have underwriters, banks that, and brokerage firms that underwrite bonds, going to companies and saying, what can we do for you? They don't want to look at the balance sheet of a company like WorldCom. They don't do any kind of research to see if it's sound. They just say, what can we do for you, Mr. Ebbers, so that we can get the hundreds of millions of dollars in fees that will get paid to us for giving you this bond issue.
Yeah, and oddly enough, when you and I go to the bank for a loan, we don't get that kind of red carpet treatment.
No, we don't.
But then on the corporate side, there's a lack of oversight of the corporations, but the corporations and their CEOs and their management still have to be willing to bend and break the laws and to push the envelope as far as they can. Well, that's their fiduciary responsibility, right, is to maximize return to their shareholders.
Ironically, these deals that provided huge, hundreds of millions of dollars in stock options to these CEOs were approved by companies who eagerly gave them to these CEOs because it was supposed to make the CEO tied to the stock performance. That was the idea.
Yeah.
Well, the downside of that is that in a system where the CEO is tied to the stock performance and rewarded that way, he's going to do everything he can, including illegal things, in order to keep the stock price up.
Yeah, what has happened is that in the name of trying to maximize the return for the shareholders, and as shareholders may include you yourself, in a very big way, to where a little bit of fidgeting on the bottom line can make you personally $50 million, and who's going to catch you? And what it becomes is a risk benefit analysis. What are the chances of getting caught? What are the penalties if you do get caught? What are the rewards if you don't get caught? Realizing that most of the violators out there who've committed these kinds of frauds, and that's basically what we're talking about, is white-collar crime, are not going to get caught. They haven't been getting caught. Many of them have sold their companies three times over since they've committed these crimes, and they'll never get caught. So it really is systemic. It all ties back to how we reward people for running companies, how companies themselves perform, and how our political system responds in the same way that these financial services do, going to the corporations and saying, here's the account number for my reelection campaign bank account. What can we do for you, Mr. Ebbers?
Exactly. And the really sick part about it is, here we're on the downside. When we're on the upside of a bubble like this, people who have jobs, say, working on phone lines or shuffling papers in an office, they think, gosh, these guys are making a lot of money, but I'm making some too. I'm putting some aside in my 401k. I'm putting some in an IRA. I'm saving some for my kids' college education. I'm making some money too. It's okay. But when the economy turns and you're on the downside, the people who really pay are those little people who put their money in the 401k, in the IRA, the granny in Ohio who's living off of a pension, this WorldCom collapse, if they default on their bonds, which it looks like they're going to do, those pension funds are going to be out a lot of money, tune of hundreds of millions of dollars.
And the biggest one is a public employees in California, I believe.
Yeah, they're going to be out something to the tune of $380 million, and that's just in WorldCom bonds. I think they're also invested in the stock as well.
Yeah,
but even people here in Washington State are to the tune of $75 million.
Yeah. And those are the people who really suffer. The people who suffer are not even the corporate criminals who get caught. I mean, Mr. Ebbers may go to prison for a couple of years in a Club Med style joint with, tennis courts and a swimming pool and, the ability to have a barbecue with his kids and grandkids on summer vacation. I mean, and then he'll be out in a couple of years and he'll be writing a book on how I bilked America and isn't it great and wasn't it fun? And I'm a bit sorry, but gosh.
And then he'll open a consultancy.
Yeah, and then he'll start consulting and he'll start, he'll have his internet column and, he'll be on all the talk shows.
And in about 5 years, he'll be completely rehabilitated and he'll be back and doing the same sort of thing during the next bubble.
Mr. Lay, Mr. Sullivan, Mr. Skilling, Mr. Fasto, they'll have their hands slapped and they'll be fine. But the rest of us, it's really going to be hard on us, those of us who thought we were actually getting something out of the uptick.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I have a feeling we're going to be coming back to this subject matter in the coming weeks.
Yeah, so. I also kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the impact of all this on the world markets. That's something we haven't been, we're so absorbed here in the U.S. on the impacts on our own stock market, our own economy, that the this whole collapse of these major corporations points to something that we hear abroad but not here, and it's that capitalism in the U.S. is crony capitalism. Now, that's a term that's been used to describe the collapse in Asia in 1997 and 98 and the collapse in economic collapse in Russia and in Latin America. Has been blamed on crony capitalism. But here in the U.S., we have crony capitalism as bad or worse as any of those places. We had, when you have banks going to companies like Enron and saying, how much money do you want to borrow? And not even looking at their financials. That's and crony capitalism.
Yeah, and they're on each other's board of directors.
Yeah, and they all, and they get huge fees for their consulting work. When you have no oversight and you have endless amounts of money flowing into corrupt companies. That's crony capitalism. And it's not that that's particular to any one part of the world. It's just the way the system functions. And this is really showing that, I think, very, very clearly. And so what's happening is you're having a world market collapse. You're not just having a collapse here in the U.S. You're having investors fleeing the U.S. So the U.S. dollar is going down in value, which is making markets all over the world tremble, because the only thing that has kept them coming, kept them growing out of their former collapse, was that the U.S. dollar was strong, which means U.S. consumers could buy a lot of imported goods. Well, that's not going to be the case now.
Yeah. And specifically with the currency, the IMF in the Third World in particular has been on a relentless campaign in recent years to tie all of these economies' currencies to the U.S. dollar.
Yeah,
directly.
And what is that going to do to them? It's going to be bad.
All right, so like I say, I think we'll be coming back to this.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be talking about this in the future show.
Different corporate names next week. So another item to hit the papers this week was Ninth Circuit Court to making a decision about the Pledge of Allegiance.
Sure.
can I just say something before
sure,
you start in,
sure.
Job? I pledge allegiance to the appointed president of the United States of America. Let's tell the truth here, okay?
Yeah. This was one of these court decisions, that, and of course it'll be overturned, and you had all of the politicians just lining up to excoriate, some of them saying breathtakingly ridiculous things. But the problem with the Pledge of Allegiance, and this was a court decision that is both at once this like long overdue burst of common sense, and you can also make the argument that it's patently ridiculous. But I think it kind of misses the point as to the Pledge of Allegiance, because the Pledge of Allegiance is not about promoting God. The phrase "under God" was instituted in 1954, and remember what was going on in 1954. It was instituted at the same time that loyalty oaths were being imposed all over the United States, and at the same time that the U.S., or at least certain portions of it, were very fearful of the communist menace. And so what
we're talking about the McCarthy era.
Yeah, we're talking about the McCarthy era, the same era that spawned much of the language in the USA Patriot Act, incidentally. And so what happens is you get the insertion of the phrase "under God" specifically so as to differentiate us, meaning God-fearing Americans, from the godless pinkos. That's where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And so we have this connotation now of loyalty. It was from the 50s as being a bad thing. And yet, you know, every day for 12 years, we're requiring our kids to recite this nonsense 20,000 times before they become adults. You know, it's a form of indoctrination, and it's a form of propaganda. Really, it's certainly imbibing some truths that I would find pretty questionable alongside the "under God." That whole bit about "with liberty and justice for all," for one, is pretty debatable. Mm-hmm. But you know, when it comes right down to it, the question shouldn't be are we forcing our kids to acknowledge monotheism, although that is a good question. The larger question is, are we forcing our kids over and over to mindlessly recite a loyalty oath? And that's the very scary thing about it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would also mention that, you know, I grew up in a rural district in South Pierce County, and my teacher always made us say amen at the end of the Pledge of the Allegiance, like we were sort of praying to the state, which you are. And the interesting thing about it is you have some parents who are very, very religious who do not want their children to say the Pledge of the Allegiance in the classroom because they feel it is praying to the state and not to God, which I find very interesting.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of Americans realize how many modifications the Pledge of Allegiance has gone through since its original, you know, inception. Mm-hmm. I think it's like had 9 different additions or changes to it over time. So
yeah, and now we tend to view it as sacred. Well, at least Congress does.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people assume no, this has just been something that's been around for like 200 years.
You know, no,
like
and
the founding
hasn't.
Fathers
not
just
not
like whipped it out there next to the Declaration of Independence. So anything else on that?
Let's
keep going.
On.
All right. You wouldn't have caught it in the news, but Maria, the FBI has a new suspect in the anthrax case?
Yes. In fact, a lot of people are wondering what's been going on with the anthrax investigation since we haven't been hearing very darn much. And it turns out the FBI has a new focus for their anthrax investigation and a new credible suspect. Now, do you think it's a foreigner? No. Do you think it's an immigrant? No. Do you think it's a disgruntled Arab American? No. Do you think it might be some kind of right-wing militia person or some loner stuck in a cabin out in the middle of the woods? No. It turns out, no, it's not. Their credible suspect is a man who used to work at the Army's Fort Detrick, or Detrick, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, laboratories, but is now works for a bioterrorism contractor for the U.S. government. And they have some very credible evidence for this guy, but it's so credible that he actually invited them in to search his apartment. He wanted to clear himself, and they took some swabs in his apartment. But then the FBI found out that he had a storage locker, and they took a rental truck out to his storage locker, and they half emptied it, taking items for testing. So I think we might hear sometime in the next week, maybe in the next month, that this is the guy that they think who did it. But the interesting thing is motive. At the time when he did, I'm not saying that he did it, but at the time when the anthrax letters were mailed, bioterrorism was not at a very high priority for funding for the U.S. military, the U.S. government. And at that point, he was working for a bioterrorism contractor. And the FBI is looking at for people who are working for bioterrorism contractors or for the military in that role because they think someone may have sent the letters in order to boost funding for bioterrorism protections.
And you know what? Even if they get caught, it will have worked.
Uh-huh. It will have absolutely worked. And we have billions of dollars going for that now. And at the same time, we have something like Amtrak having to beg hat in hand for $200 million in order to keep the trains running.
Yeah, it's funny how we have all of these different really pressing social needs where you go to Congress or you go to state legislatures with your hat in your hand and, oh, well, there's no money. We can't find any money for this. But you turn around and you get somebody who hits on a really clever fundraising scheme for their company. Hey, I know. Let's kill a few people just to show there's a threat
people,
out there.
Yeah.
And suddenly the bill come pouring in. Where did that money come from, and how come it can't be used to save people's lives rather than inspire people to inspire criminals to kill someone?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds like just another direct mail campaign used to increase shareholders'
earnings.
Yeah,
it's a direct mail campaign that went directly to Democratic members of Congress.
And media outlets, too.
Some media outlets,
yeah. So, okay, well, we'll...
And killed some other people who were in the way.
Yeah, yeah. And happened to really...
Postal employees.
Yeah, really put a scare on postal
and at least
employees.
And at least one or two people who got cross-contaminated in the mail, right. The elderly woman in Brooklyn, and I think there was a woman in Connecticut
and
also.
And caused millions of dollars in cleanup costs.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, so it sounds like that's another story we'll be coming back to. Moving right along.
Yeah, when it gets into the headlines eventually, finally.
All right, when we finally hear about it.
We'll cover
when it starts fitting into our national myth of what we want people to believe.
Well, it's a pretty big myth they got going.
That's
so.
True.
To the Republic.
For which it stands.
All right, moving along. Our mayor, Greg Nichols, seems to be going 180 degrees of what city council and the rest of the citizens want.
Well, and 180 degrees from what Mayor Greg Nichols. Are we talking about transit, or are we talking about the police here?
We're talking about the police here.
Okay, let's start with the police. Yeah.
We can move to transit.
Yeah, also 180 degrees from where Greg Nichols was a couple of weeks ago, interestingly enough. For folks who missed this, earlier this week, I believe it was on Monday, the city council voted pretty narrowly, 5-4, to approve collection of racial profiling data in police cars. And also it was 7-2, I believe, they voted for a pilot program that would put 25 cameras in different patrol cars around the city. Well, this, of course, came just a couple days after the shooting over the weekend of a King County Sheriff's deputy, a man named Herzog, trying to confront a naked, either mentally disturbed or drug-taking African-American gentleman out in the streets, and the naked man took away his gun and shot him. And so, of course, we've had all of the, you know, the blue funeral and the hagiographies, or however it's pronounced, of the deputy this week. But at the same time, you've got the city council saying, well, we're backing down on our earlier promise of this minimal step of accountability of, you know, everybody agrees that racial profiling is bad, and so we're going to get into the headlines and say, yes, racial profiling is bad, but we're not even going to take the steps necessary to quantify that it exists. Although, you know, you don't really need more studies at this point. What you need is ways to end it, which is what the cameras would be. But the studies would be at least a nice gesture that it's something that people care about. Well, Jim Compton, the chair of the city council's public safety committee, voted against this. Gil Kerlikowski, the Seattle police chief, is adamant against it, and even more adamant is the Seattle Police Officers Guild, which opposes not only the collection of data, but it also opposes, if data was to be collected, the identification of officers and a number of other details that are sort of essential to making the system work.
And they threatened to depolice.
Yeah, and they threatened to depolice over this issue. Heaven forbid that citizens have any kind of information on what our public employees do, let alone having those employees be accountable, which is a whole other argument. But so you have all of these people lining up against it, and then Greg Nichols' folks come out on Monday and say, oh, and by the way, the mayor is considering vetoing this, even though he was four square against it previously. by the way, if the city is forced to haggle with the Police Officers Guild over this in the upcoming contract negotiations, well, that might just force us to take the cameras off the table too, and not put those in the patrol car. So, you know, you're already getting this kind of maneuvering, saying, well, these, you know, we're not going to cooperate with any of this unless it becomes acceptable, unless we just go ahead and take the collection of data off the table entirely. So lo and behold, yesterday Nichols does in fact go ahead and veto this, or announce he was going to veto it, and you know, and it really is rather disturbing, because you figure you look at the racial divide of what's happening in this city. The shooting last weekend was essentially the mirror image of what happened a year ago with Aaron Roberts, where you have a black guy, middle-aged, with a history of criminal violations and a history of drug use, being confronted with a cop, and he reacts badly. Well, in that case, Aaron Roberts was shot. In this case, it was the officer who was shot. And I can guarantee you that if it had gone the other way, and if it had been a naked man in the street who was shot by the deputy after the naked man was reaching for the gun, you would have had demonstrations, you would have had calls for accountability. Of course, you know, they probably wouldn't have gone anywhere, as we're seeing with the city jurisdiction this week. But instead, you have a King County Sheriff Reichert coming out and saying, well, anybody who even mentions race ahead of this, I'm not even going to dignify that with an answer. Just don't go there. We don't care about racist and race, and furthermore, we're tired of being called racists. Well, number one, saying that race is an issue is not the same as calling people racists. Number two, using the term racism is in the context of institutional racism is not the same as racist, although I think at this point the R word itself is simply not helpful because people just see red when they hear it.
Well, this current shooting did have an element of race.
Yeah, of course it did.
We're talking about
that's the
criminal justice system gave up on.
Yeah. So, Riker is talking about, essentially, number one, he equated talking about race with calling cops racists, which is not accurate. Mm-hmm. And then number two, he tried to shut down all discussion about race when I guarantee you there is no way on earth that a black man, having been in and out of the criminal justice system so many times, and with the recent history of shootings, is not A, likely to react differently than a white suspect would when confronted with an officer, because he may feel that he's fighting for his life in a way that a white suspect would not, and that B, officers know this also, and their responses might be different than that were if it were a white suspect. So you have to have this kind of a discussion. Unfortunately, the city of Seattle and our region is very, very good, or at least its white power structure is very good, in saying, let's not even talk about race, because we're all good liberals here. None of us goes around burning crosses in the front lawn or wearing a white hood. And so it's not even a problem. Let's pretend it doesn't exist. You have a huge chunk of your non-white population saying it's an enormous problem, but their voices don't really count. We're not racists. It's a very, very disturbing dynamic, and until people can start having those discussions honestly, these shootings are going to keep happening. You're going to keep getting more dead police, many more dead unarmed black men, and it's just going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on that? Or
no, let's
all
move
right.
on.
We also have happening locally in the region. Sound Transit apparently Renton says no sale.
yes, the city
as did Tukwila.
Yeah, the city of Renton was in line to do a sale of some land to Sound Transit for its commuter rail, its heavy rail, and they're going back on that now and saying no, we don't want to sell that land. So that's another roadblock put up for Sound Transit.
Yeah, it's amazing how many of these different. Different roadblocks, and particularly around light rail, keep coming up, and how Sound Transit keeps plowing ahead. There isn't quite as much public outrage these days because we're not getting headlines about vast cost overruns because they went ahead and got many of those out of the way early, right? I mean, it's not like they've cut back on any of those costs. They just haven't kept compounding that problem, and so we're supposed to give them credit for that.
They
will.
As soon as you have cities like Tukwila and Renton saying, no, sorry, we can't deal with you, the costs go up immediately.
Of course they do. And at the same time, you're losing more and more of your intergovernmental funding. Sound Transit was fortunate to get some stuff out of the legislature this year. Probably not going to happen again. The federal government has been balking and dragging its heels in progressively more adamant ways for several years now.
And speaking of that, the regional transportation plan won't be going to the ballot this year just because two county councilmen, King County councilmen, couldn't decide on how much money for Sound Transit. Dwight Pelz wants $1 billion to go to Sound Transit to extend it to Northgate, and Rob McKenna says no. If you put that on the plan, it won't pass the voters. And so it's not even going to go to the ballot in November.
Yeah.
I think I talked about this last week. I predicted that it wouldn't go on the ballot for this reason, and it's not going to.
And give Rob McKenna, a fairly conservative Bellevue Republican with political ambitions. He wants to replace Jennifer Dunn. He's right on this. It wouldn't pass if he put that as part of the plan.
And McKenna is not anti-transit. He actually proposed $300 million more in transit funding for the regional transportation plan than Pelz would. It's just that his funding would go for buses, HOV lanes, and possibly some for the monorail, but none for light rail.
But regardless, you've still got this issue that's obviously a hot issue, I think, with a lot of people, a lot of the population, and they couldn't go anywhere with it.
That's right.
Yeah, it's probably going to be one of the biggest public spending scandals. It already is, actually, in regional history. I mean, it's right up there in terms of sheer dollar amount with the whoops.
Yeah.
And yet, nothing seems to slow this thing down. it's a bureaucracy that's taken on a life of its own, and it's very, because it's claiming to help solve a very pressing regional need, which it will not particularly help solve, and you know, they're taking it as, it's a gravy train. Mm-hmm. For all the consultants and for all of the bureaucrats who are making money off of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, here another one that's coming up quickly on that gravy train for scandals is the third, or some people say second and a half runway, has already said that, oh gosh, we got the numbers wrong again, and it looks like it's going to be more. But
well,
unfortunately, that's another story.
And, well,
another
we should talk about that another week, and also the many, many environmental problems with that runway project, too.
Right. Exactly.
All right. So for this week, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with Jov Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And one of you, tell us, what is Eat the State?
Okay,
I did it last week.
I guess it's Mike. You did everything last week.
That's right.
And it is a wonderful little biweekly publication put out by volunteers, which could include you. Covers global as well as local news, some humor, a lot of research, a lot of opinion. And we think it's a fine little publication. And you can get it free of charge at bookstores and libraries and places where you hang out and read free publications. You can also find it on the web, www.eatthestate.org. If you would like to help out, if you'd like to volunteer, if you have story tips or ideas or feedback, give us a call. The voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.
All right, and you're both back next week, right?
Well, I am.
Unless I land in the hospital again, I plan to be, yeah.
All right, good. Then we'll talk to you both then.
Thanks.
Thanks.